Europe. Cecil Bradshaw led that strong faction in Chatham House, which convinced the new foreign minister that these promises were charming but not very practical, and that Britain's interests lay with the Arabs. The Arabs' 10 million square miles were rich in oil and included a vital canal. General Sir Clarence Tever Brown and Humphrey Crawford were ushered into Cecil Bradshaw's office. The latter, a fat man in his 60s, stood looking at the wall with his back to them, his pudgy hands clasped behind him. Humphrey Crawford sat down nervously on the edge of a seat. Tever Brown made himself comfortable in a deep leather chair and lit a cigar. Bradshaw talked to the wall.
"Congratulations, gentlemen," he said in a voice filled with sarcasm and quivering with anger. "I see we made the news today."
He turned and patted his rotund stomach and smiled.
"You expected to find me in a lather. No, indeed. No, indeed. Whitehall called this morning. As expected, the minister has dumped this Exodus business into my lap."
Bradshaw sat behind his desk, glanced at the reports, and snatched off his thick, horn-rimmed glasses with a quick gesture.
"Tell me, Sir Clarence, was your intelligence staff dead or merely out for tennis? And I believe you have a bit of explaining to do about Sutherland. He was your idea."
Tever Brown refused to be bullied.
"I believe the establishment of camps on Cyprus was your idea. What is your explanation?"
"Gentlemen," Crawford said quickly to avert a clash, "we are faced with a peculiar situation in this Exodus affair. This is the first time any publicity has carried into the American press."
Bradshaw laughed, a wheezy laugh. His big apple cheeks reddened.
"With all of Truman's talk, the Americans have only allowed 10,000 Jewish refugees into the country since the end of the war. Certainly Truman is for Zionism, as long as Palestine isn't in Pennsylvania. Everyone talks idealistically, but we are still the ones with 1 million Jews on our hands. 1 million Jews who could ruin our entire position in the Middle East."
Bradshaw replaced his glasses.
"Star of David, Moses, Palmach, Gates of Zion, Door of Hope, and now the Exodus. The Zionists are very clever people. For 25 years they have made us the villains in Palestine. They write words into the Mandate Articles and the Balfour Declaration that were never meant. They can argue a camel into thinking he is a mule. Good Lord, 2 hours with Chaim Weizmann, and I'm about ready to join the Zionists myself."
Cecil Bradshaw took off his glasses again.
"We know your sympathies, Tever Brown." "I resent the implications, Bradshaw. Perhaps I am one of a few hardheads who say the only way we are going to hold the Middle East is by building a powerful Jewish Palestine. I don't speak of Jewish interest, but I speak of British interest."
Bradshaw interrupted.
"Now, let's get to this Exodus affair. The implications are absolutely clear. We gave in on the Promised Land, but this time we will not give in. This boat is in our waters and not in French waters. We will not go on board. We will not send them to Germany. We will not sink them. They will sit in Kyrenia until they rot. Rot! Do you hear that, Tever Brown? Rot!"
His hand began to shake as he grew angrier. Tever Brown closed his eyes.
"We cannot fight this out on moral grounds. We have no cause to keep 300 children who were raised in concentration camps from entering Palestine. Oil, canals, Arabs be damned. We have no cause. We made ourselves look ridiculous by sending the Promised Land refugees to Germany. I know your sympathies. Gentlemen,"
Tever Brown stood up and leaned over Bradshaw's desk,
"there is only one way we can win this Exodus affair. The Jews have planned this whole incident to create propaganda. Turn the tables on them. Let the Exodus sail this minute. That is what they don't want. Never. Can't you see, sir, that we're playing right into their hands? That ship will not sail as long as I am in Chatham House.
Chapter 31. Mark Parker, Dome Hotel, Kyrenia, Cyprus. Story gaining momentum. Keep them coming. Ken Bradbury, ANS, London. Kyrenia, Cyprus, ANS, by Mark Parker. It is a ridiculous sight. 1,000 armed soldiers, tanks, artillery, and a naval task force all looking helplessly out at an unarmed salvage tug. The Battle of the Exodus ends week one in a draw. Both the British and the refugees are holding fast. To date, no one has boarded the illegal runner, which has threatened to blow itself up. But from the quay, it is only a few hundred yards distant, and a pair of field glasses bring the boat an arm's length away. The morale of the 300 children on the Exodus seems to be phenomenal. They spent the week in the harbor alternately singing and catcalling to the British troops on the quay and seawall. Mark's reports went out daily, each new one adding new and interesting details. When Cecil Bradshaw made the decision to make a test case of the Exodus, he knew there would be a barrage of adverse criticism. The French press staged its usual uproar, although this time the insults were so terrible that the likes of them had not been heard in the history of the Anglo-French alliance. The story spread throughout Europe, and even the British press became split and questioned Whitehall's wisdom in not letting the Exodus sail for Palestine. Bradshaw was a wise politician, and he had weathered many storms. This one was a storm in a teacup, and it would blow over, he was sure. He sent a trio of friendly journalists to Kyrenia to counter Parker's reports, and a half-dozen experts worked full-time to explain the British position. The British had a case, and it was being presented well, but it was difficult to offset natural sentiment for a group of refugee children. If the Zionists are so sincere, why are they endangering the lives of 300 innocent children? The whole thing is a sinister and cold-blooded plot to create sympathy and becloud the real issues of the Palestine Mandate. It is obvious we are dealing with fanatics. Ari Ben Kanan is a professional Zionist agitator with a record of years of illegal operations. Newspapermen from half a dozen countries landed at the Nicosia airport and demanded permission to enter the Kyrenia area. Several large magazines also sent in teams. The Dome Hotel began to look like a small political convention headquarters. In cafes in Paris, the British were denounced. In pubs in London, the British were defended. In Stockholm, there were sermons. In Rome, there were debates. In New York, bookies were laying 4-1 that the Exodus would not sail. At the end of the second week, Ari granted Mark permission to board the ship. Mark picked what he believed to be the ripe moment and arranged it by preset signals. Since he was the first outsider to board the Exodus, his next three reports were carried by every newspaper on the front page. Exclusive interview with Exodus spokesman Ari Ben Kanan, Kyrenia, Cyprus, ANS. Today I became the first correspondent to interview Ari Ben Kanan, the spokesman for the children on the Exodus. I confronted Ben Kanan with the barrage of British reports maintaining that he was a professional Zionist troublemaker and with other Whitehall accusations. We spoke in the wheelhouse of the boat, the only place aboard not teeming with humanity. Today the children seem still to be in top spirits, but are starting to show physical effects of their two-week siege. Ben Kanan, 30, and a strapping six-footer with black hair and ice-blue eyes, could be mistaken for a movie leading man. He expressed his gratitude to well-wishers around the world and assured me the children were holding up fine. In reply to my questions, he answered, "I don't care about the personal attacks on me. I wonder if the British added that I was a captain in their army during World War II. I admit I am a Zionist troublemaker, and I will continue to be one until they keep their promises about Palestine. Whether my work is legal or not is a matter of opinion. I pressed him about the British arguments and the importance of the Exodus. We Jews are blamed for many things, and we are used to it. In anything concerning the Palestine mandate that cannot be explained logically and reasonably, they drag out the old excuse that it is some sinister plot of Zionism. I am really amazed that they haven't blamed the Zionists for the trouble they are having in India. Fortunately for us, Gandhi is not Jewish. Whitehall is using that tired whipping boy, the mysterious Zionists, to cover 3 decades of dirty work, lies to both Jews and Arabs, sellouts, double crosses, and betrayals in the mandate. The first promise they broke was the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which promised a Jewish homeland, and they have been breaking promises ever since. The latest double cross has come from the Labour Party, which, before the elections, promised to open the doors of Palestine to survivors of Hitler's regime. I am astounded at Whitehall's crocodile tears over our victimizing of children. Every child on the Exodus is a volunteer. Every child on the Exodus is an orphan because of Hitlerism. Nearly every child has lived in either German or British concentration camps for 6 years. If Whitehall is so concerned about the welfare of these children, then I challenge them to throw open the gates of Karaolos to inspection of the newsmen. It is nothing more or less than a concentration camp. People are kept behind barbed wire at machine gun point with insufficient food, water, and medical care. No charges have been brought against these people, but they are being forcibly detained in Karaolos. Whitehall talks of our trying to bully them into an unjust solution of the mandate. There are 250,000 Jews in Europe who survived, out of 6 million. The British quota of Jews allowed into Palestine is 700 a month. Is this their just solution? Finally, I argue the right of the British in Palestine. Have they more right to be there than the survivors of Hitler? Let me read you something. With that, Ben Kanan took a Bible from the desk of the wheelhouse, opened it to Ezekiel, and read, "Thus saith the Lord God, When I shall have gathered the house of Israel from the people among whom they are scattered, and shall be sanctified in them in the sight of the nations, then shall they dwell in their land that I have given to my servant Jacob, wherein your fathers abode, and they shall abide therein, and even they and their children and their children's children forever." Ari Ben Kanan put the Bible down. The gentlemen at Whitehall had better study their claims further. I say the same thing to the foreign minister that a great man said to another oppressor 3,000 years ago. Let my people go. The day after his Let My People Go report, Mark followed up with the inside story of Operation Gideon, including details of how British trucks had been used in the escape. British prestige hit a low water mark. On Mark's advice, Ari allowed other newsmen to board the Exodus, and they clamored to be let into the Karaolis camp. Cecil Bradshaw had expected criticism, but he had not reckoned on the furor that had been created. Meeting followed meeting. As for that moment in time, the eyes of the world focused on Kyrenia Harbor. To allow the Exodus to sail would be completely disastrous now. General Sir Clarence Tever Brown flew secretly to Cyprus to take command and see whether something could be done. His plane landed in the small hours of the morning under security measures at the Nicosia Aerodrome. Major Alastair met him, and they quickly entered a staff car, and it whisked off toward Famagusta headquarters.
"I wanted to speak to you, Alastair, before I took over from Sutherland. Of course, I received your letter, and you are free to speak."
"Well, sir," Alastair said, "I would say that the strain has got Sutherland down. Something has happened to the man. Caldwell tells me he has one nightmare after another. He walks all night long till dawn, and he spends most of his days reading the Bible."
"Damned shame," Tepper Brown said. "Bruce has been a corking good soldier. I trust what is said will never leave this car. We must protect the man.
Of course, sir, Alistair said.
Kyrenia Cyprus, AP, exclusive. General Sir Clarence Tever Brown, of desert fame, landed anonymously at Nicosia Airdrome last night. Sir Clarence was dressed in civilian clothes, and his arrival was marked by secrecy. Tever Brown's appearance on the scene confirms Whitehall's concern over the exodus. It could indicate a change in policy, if not a change in command. Mark boarded the exodus and asked that Karen be sent to the wheelhouse. He was worried as he pushed his way over the crowded deck. The children were looking gaunt, and they smelled bad from the lack of water to wash with. Ari was in the wheelhouse, as placid as ever. Mark gave him cigarettes and a few bottles of brandy.
"How's it going out there?" Ari asked.
"Doesn't look like any change in policy with Tever Brown in. The story is still tops all over, bigger than I expected."
"Look, Ari, this thing has worked perfectly for you and me both. You've done what you started out to do, given the British a black eye. The word I got is that the British are not going to back down."
"What's the point?"
"The point is you can top this whole thing off by making a humanity move and taking the ship to dock. We'll make a big story when the British march them back to Karaolos. It will tear the people's hearts out."
"Did Kitty send you in with this?"
"Oh, cut it out, will you? Just look down there at those kids. They're starting to come apart."
"They knew what they were in for.
There's another thing, Ari. I'm afraid we've hit the mark with this story. We're on top now, but tomorrow Frank Sinatra may unload a left hook on some columnist in a nightclub and we're off page one."
Karen entered the wheelhouse.
"Hello, Mr. Parker,"
she said softly.
"Hello, honey. Here's a letter from Kitty and a package."
She took the letter and gave Mark one for Kitty. She refused the package, as she had refused all the other packages.
"Christ, I haven't got the heart to tell Kitty she won't take the packages for herself. That girl is sick. Did you see the circles under her eyes? You're going to have real trouble on this ship in another few days."
"We were speaking of maintaining public interest. Get one thing straight, Parker. We don't go back to Karaolos. There are 250,000 Jews in Europe waiting for an answer, and we are the only ones who can answer them. Starting tomorrow, we will declare a hunger strike. Anyone who passes out will be placed on deck for the British to look at."
"You ghoul. You stinking ghoul," Mark snarled.
"Call me what you want, Parker. Do you think I like starving a bunch of orphans? Give me something else to fight with. Give me something to shoot at those tanks and those destroyers. All we've got is our guts and what we believe in. We've had the hell knocked out of us for 2,000 years. This is one fight we're going to win."
Chapter 32. Hunger strike called on Exodus. Children vow starvation rather than return to Karaolos. After allowing the story to build up over a 2-week period, Ari Ben-Kanan fooled everyone by launching an offensive. It was no game of wait and see now. The children were forcing a decision. A huge sign was tied to the sides of the Exodus with lettering in English, French, and Hebrew. The sign read, "Hunger Strike, Hour Number 1. Hunger Strike, Hour Number 15. Two boys and a girl aged 10, 12, and 15 were brought on the forward deck of the Exodus and laid out unconscious. Hunger Strike, Hour Number 20. 10 children were stretched out on the forward deck.
"For Christ's sake, Kitty, stop pacing and sit down."
"It's over 20 hours now. How much longer is he going to let this go on? I just haven't had the courage to go to the quay and look. Is Karen one of those children unconscious on deck?"
"I told you 10 times she wasn't."
"They aren't strong children to begin with, and they've been cooped up on that ship for 2 weeks. They have no stamina left."
Kitty pulled nervously at a cigarette and tugged at her hair.
That man is a beast, an inhuman beast.
I've been thinking about that, Mark said. I've been thinking about it a lot. I wonder if we really understand what is driving those people so hard. Have you ever seen Palestine? It's worthless desert in the south end and eroded in the middle and swamp up north. It's stinking, it's sunbaked, and it's in the middle of a sea of 50 million sworn enemies. Yet they break their necks to get there. They call it the land of milk and honey. They sing about water sprinklers and irrigation ditches. 2 weeks ago I told Ari Ben Kanan that the Jews don't have a patent on suffering. But I'm beginning to wonder. I swear, I wonder. I wonder how something can hurt so badly that can drive them so hard.
Don't defend them, Mark, and don't defend those people.
Try to remember one thing. Ben Kanan couldn't do this without the support of those kids. They're behind him 100%.
That's what hurts, Kitty said. This loyalty, this fantastic loyalty they have for each other.
The phone rang. Mark answered, listened, and hung up.
What is it? I said, what is it, Mark?
They've brought some more kids up on the deck unconscious. A half dozen of them.
Is Karen?
I don't know. I'm going to find out.
Mark?
What?
I want to go on the Exodus.
That's impossible.
I can't take it anymore,
she said. If you do this, you're finished.
No, Mark. It's different. If I knew she were alive and well, I could bear it. I swear I could. I made myself know that. But I can't just sit idly and know she's dying. I can't do that.
Even if I can get Ben Kanan to let you on the Exodus, the British won't let you.
You must, she said fiercely. You must.
She stood with her back to the door and blocked his exit, her face determined. Mark lowered his eyes. I'll do what I can, he said. Hunger strike. Hour number 35. Angry crowds in Paris and Rome demonstrated before the British embassies. Fierce oratory and placards demanded the release of the Exodus. Police clubs and tear gas were used in Paris to disperse the mob. In Copenhagen and in Stockholm and in Brussels and in The Hague, there were other demonstrations. These were more orderly. Hunger strike. Hour number 38. A spontaneous general strike swept over the island of Cyprus in protest against the British. Transportation stopped. Businesses shut down and ports closed. Theaters and restaurants locked their doors. Famagusta, Nicosia, Larnaca, and Limassol looked like morgues. Hunger strike. Hour number 40. Ari Ben Kanan stared at his lieutenants. He looked into the somber faces of Yoav, David, Zev, and Hank Schlossberg. Zev, the Galilee farmer, spoke up first. I am a soldier. I cannot stand by and watch children starve to death. In Palestine, Ari snapped, youngsters this same age are already fighters in Gadna. It is one thing to fight, and it is another to starve to death. This is only another way of fighting, Ari said. Yoav Yarkoni had worked with Ari for many years and had served with him in World War II. I have never gone against you, Ari. The minute one of these children dies, this whole thing is liable to boomerang on us. Ari looked over to Hank Schlossberg, the American captain. Hank shrugged. You're the boss, Ari, but the crew is getting jittery. They didn't bargain for this. In other words, Ari said, you want to surrender. Their silence confirmed it. David? What about you? I haven't heard from you. David, a scholar, was steeped in the Torah and in the holy books. He had a closeness to God that none of the rest of them had, and they respected it.
6 million Jews died in gas chambers, not knowing why they died, he said. If 300 of us on the Exodus die, we will certainly know why. The world will know too. When we were a nation 2,000 years ago, and when we rebelled against Roman and Greek rule, we Jews established the tradition of fighting to the last man. We did this at Arbila and Jerusalem. We did this at Betar and Herodium and Machaerus. At Masada, we held out against the Romans for 4 years, and when they entered the fort, they found us all dead. No people, anywhere, have fought for their freedom as have our people. We drove the Romans and the Greeks from our land until we were dispersed to the four corners of the world. We have not had much opportunity to fight as a nation for 2,000 years. When we had that opportunity at the Warsaw Ghetto, we did honor to our tradition. I say, if we leave this boat and willingly return to barbed wire prisons, then we will have broken faith with God.
Are there any further questions? Ari said. Hunger strike. Hour number 42. In the United States, South Africa, and England, mass prayer meetings were being held in synagogues. And in many churches, there were prayers for the safety of the children on the Exodus. Hunger strike. Hour number 45. The Jews in Argentina began to fast in sympathy with the children aboard the Exodus. Hunger strike. Hour number 47. It was getting dark as Kitty boarded the Exodus. The stench was overpowering. All over the deck, in the lifeboats, on the superstructure, she saw the crush of humanity. Everyone was lying down and absolutely motionless to conserve energy.
I want to see those children who have passed out, she said.
David led her to the bow of the ship, where there were 3 rows of unconscious children, 60 in number. David knelt and held his lantern close to the bodies as Kitty moved from one to the other, feeling their pulses and looking into the pupils of their eyes. 6 times she thought she would faint as her heart pounded, and she rolled over a child who looked like Karen. David led her around the packed deck, stepping over the prostrate bodies. The children stared listlessly at her with dazed eyes. Their hair was matted and dirt caked their faces. David led her down the steep ladder onto the hold. She nearly vomited as the stink enveloped her. In the half-light, she saw the ghastly sight of the children packed in shelves, one atop the other. On the deck of the hold, they lay piled against each other. She found Karen in a corner, enmeshed in a tangle of arms and legs. Dov was asleep next to her. They lay on a pile of rags, and the deck was slimy beneath them.
Karen? She whispered. Karen, it's me, Kitty.
Karen's eyes fluttered open. There were huge black circles beneath them, and her lips were caked dry. She was too weak to sit up.
Kitty? Yes, it's me.
Karen held her arms open, and Kitty held her tightly for many moments.
Don't leave, Kitty. I'm so frightened. I'll be near,
Kitty whispered, releasing the girl. She went to the hospital and examined the limited supply of drugs and sighed despondently.
There is very little that can be done, she said to David. I'll try to make them as comfortable as possible. Can you and Yoav work with me?
Of course.
Some of those unconscious are in serious condition. We'll have to try to sponge them to get their fevers down. It is chilly up on deck. We'll keep them covered. Then I want everyone who is capable of working to get this ship clean.
Kitty labored feverishly for hours to ward off death. It was like trying to fill an ocean with a thimble. As soon as one child was brought under control, three more became seriously ill. She hadn't the drugs, water, or other facilities to do very much. Food, the one weapon, could not be used. Hunger strike. Hour number 81. 70 children in coma lay on the deck of the Exodus. On the quay of Kyrenia Harbor, there were angry grumbles of insubordination from the British ranks. Many of the soldiers could stand it no longer and asked to be removed, even at the risk of court-martial. The eyes of Cyprus fastened on Kyrenia. Hunger strike. Hour number 82. Karen Hansen Clement was carried to the bow of the ship, unconscious. Hunger strike. Hour number 83. Kitty walked into the wheelhouse and slumped exhausted into a chair. She had worked for 35 straight hours and her mind was muddled and dazed. Ari poured her a stiff brandy.
"Go on and drink," he said. "You aren't on strike."
She swallowed it down, and a second drink brought her to her senses. She stared at Ari Ben Kanan long and hard. He was a powerful man. He showed almost no effects of the siege. She looked into his cold eyes and wondered what thoughts, what plots, what tricks were running through his brain. She wondered if he was frightened, or even knew fear. She wondered if he was sad or shaken.
"I was expecting you to come up here to see me much sooner," he said.
"I won't beg you, Ari Ben Kanan. Ben Kanan and God, in that order. Isn't that right? Well, there are a dozen children on the verge of death. I am merely reporting to you like a good Palmachnik. They're going to die. Mr. Ben Kanan, how do you rule?"
"I've been insulted before, Kitty. It doesn't bother me. Is this humanity of yours so great that it cries out for all these children, or does it appeal for the life of one child?"
"You have no right to ask that."
"You are begging for the life of one girl. I am begging for the lives of 250,000 people."
She rose.
"I had better get back to work. Ari, you knew why I wanted to come on board the Exodus. Why did you let me?"
He turned his back to her and looked from the window out to sea, where the cruiser and destroyer stood watch.
"Maybe I wanted to see you."
Hunger strike. Hour number 85. General Sir Clarence Tever Brown paced up and down Sutherland's office. The smoke from his cigar clouded the room. He stopped several times and looked out the window in the direction of Kyrenia. Sutherland tapped out his pipe and studied the array of sandwiches on the tray on the coffee table.
"Won't you sit down, Sir Clarence, and have a bite to eat and a spot of tea?"
Tever Brown looked at his wristwatch and sighed. He seated himself and picked up a sandwich, stared at it, nibbled, then threw it down.
"I feel guilty when I eat," he said. "This is a bad business to be in for a man with a conscience," Sutherland said. 2 wars, 11 foreign posts, 6 decorations, and 3 orders. Now I've been stopped in my tracks by a band of unarmed children. A fine way to end 30 years of service, eh, Sir Clarence?"
Tever Brown lowered his eyes.
"Oh, I know you've been wanting to talk to me," said Sutherland.
Tever Brown poured some tea and sighed, half embarrassed.
"See here, Bruce. If it were up to me..."
"Nonsense, Sir Clarence.
Don't feel badly. It is I who feel badly. I let you down."
Sutherland rose, and his eyes brimmed.
"I am tired. I am very tired."
"We will arrange a full pension and have the retirement as quiet as possible.
You can count on me, Tevor Brown said. See here, Bruce. I stopped over in Paris on my way here, and I had a long talk with Neddy. I told her about your predicament. Listen, old boy, with some encouragement from you, you two could get together again. Neddy wants you back, and you're going to need her.
Sutherland shook his head.
Neddy and I have been through for years. All we ever had between us that was meaningful was the army. That's what held us together.
Any plans?
These months on Cyprus have done something to me, Sir Clarence. Especially these past few weeks. You may not believe this, but I don't feel that I've suffered a defeat. I feel that I may have won something very great. Something I lost a long time ago.
And what is that?
Truth. Do you remember when I took this post? You told me that the only kingdom that runs on right and wrong is the kingdom of heaven, and the kingdoms of the earth run on oil.
I remember it well, Tevor Brown said.
Yes, Sutherland said. I have thought so much about it since this Exodus affair. All my life I have known the truth, and I have known right from wrong. Most of us do. To know the truth is one thing. To live it, to create the kingdom of heaven on earth is another. How many times in a man's life does he do things that are repulsive to his morality in order to exist? How I have admired those few men in this world who could stand up for their convictions in the face of shame, torture, and even death. What a wonderful feeling of inner peace they must have. Something that we ordinary mortals can never know. Gandhi is such a man. I am going to that rotten sliver of land that these Jews call their kingdom of heaven on earth. I want to know it all. Galilee, Jerusalem, all of it.
I envy you, Bruce.
Perhaps I'll settle down near Swat on Mount Canaan.
Major Alastair entered the office. He was pale, and his hand shook as he gave Tevor Brown a note to read. Tevor Brown read it and reread it and could not believe his eyes.
Great God, save us all, he whispered.
He passed the note to Bruce Sutherland. Urgent. Ari Ben Kanan, spokesman for the Exodus, announced that beginning at noon tomorrow, 10 volunteers a day will commit suicide on the bridge of the ship in full view of the British garrison. This protest practice will continue until either the Exodus is permitted to sail for Palestine or everyone aboard is dead. Bradshaw, with Humphrey Crawford and half a dozen aides, sped out of London to the quiet of a peaceful, isolated little house in the country. He had 14 hours to act before the suicides on the Exodus began. He had badly miscalculated the entire thing. First, the tenacity and determination of the children on the ship. Second, the powerful propaganda the incident created. Finally, he had not imagined that Ben Kanan would take the offensive and press the issue as he had. Bradshaw was a stubborn man, but he knew when he was defeated, and he now turned his efforts to making a face-saving settlement. Bradshaw had Crawford and his aides cable or phone a dozen of the top Jewish leaders in England, Palestine, and the United States to ask them to intervene. The Palestinians in particular might possibly dissuade Ben Kanan. At the very least, they could stall the action long enough to enable Bradshaw to come up with some alternate plans. If he could get Ben Kanan to agree to negotiate, then he could talk the Exodus to death. Within 6 hours, Bradshaw had his answers from the Jewish leaders. They answered uniformly, "We will not intercede." Next, Bradshaw contacted Tevor Brown on Cyprus. He instructed the general to inform the Exodus that the British were working out a compromise and to delay the deadline for 24 hours. Tevar Brown carried out these instructions and relayed Ben Canaan's answer back to England. Urgent. Ben Canaan informed us there is nothing to discuss. He says either the Exodus sails or it doesn't sail. He further states that complete amnesty to the Palestinians aboard is part of the conditions. Ben Canaan summarized, "Let my people go." Tevar Brown. Cecil Bradshaw could not sleep. He paced back and forth, back and forth. It was just a little over 6 hours before the children on the Exodus would begin committing suicide. He had only 3 hours left in which to make a decision to hand to the cabinet. No compromise could be reached. Was he fighting a madman? Or was this Ari Ben Canaan a shrewd and heartless schemer who had deftly led him deeper and deeper into a trap? Let my people go. Bradshaw walked to his desk and flicked on the lamp. Urgent. Ari Ben Canaan, spokesman for the Exodus, announced that beginning at noon tomorrow, 10 volunteers a day will commit suicide. 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 Bradshaw's hand shook so violently he dropped the paper. Also on his desk were a dozen communiques from various European and American governments. In that polite language that diplomats use, they all expressed concern over the Exodus impasse. He also had notes from each of the Arab governments expressing the view that if the Exodus were permitted to sail for Palestine, it would be considered an affront to every Arab. Cecil Bradshaw was confused now. The past few days had been a living hell. How had it all begun? 30 years of formulating Middle Eastern policy, and now he was in his worst trouble over an unarmed salvage tug. What queer trick of fate had given him the mantle of an oppressor? Nobody could possibly accuse him of being anti-Jewish. Secretly, Bradshaw admired the Jews in Palestine and understood the meaning of their return. He enjoyed the hours he had spent arguing with Zionists around conference tables, bucking their brilliant debaters. Cecil Bradshaw believed from the bottom of his heart that England's interest lay with the Arabs, yet the mandate had grown to over 500,000 Jews, and the Arabs were adamant that the British were fostering a Jewish nation in their midst. During all the years of work, he had been realistic with himself. What was happening? He could see his own grandchildren lying on the deck of the Exodus. Bradshaw knew his Bible as well as any well-brought-up Englishman, and like most Englishmen, had a tremendous sense of honor, although he was not deeply religious. Could it be that the Exodus was driven by mystic forces? No. He was a practical diplomat, and he did not believe in the supernatural. Yet, he had an army and a navy and the power to squash the Exodus and all the other illegal runners. But he could not bring himself to do it. The Pharaoh of Egypt had had might on his side, too. Sweat ran down Bradshaw's face. It was all nonsense. He was tired and the pressure had been too great. What foolishness. Let my people go. Bradshaw walked to the library and found a Bible, and in near panic began to read through the pages of Exodus and about the 10 plagues that God sent down on the land of Egypt. Was he Pharaoh? Would a curse rain down on Britain? He went back to his room and tried to rest, but a staccato rhythm kept running through his tired brain. Let my people go. Let my people go.
Crawford! He yelled. Crawford!
Crawford ran in, tying his robe.
You called.
Crawford, get through to Tevar Brown on Cyprus at once. Tell him...
Tell him to let the Exodus sail for Palestine.
Book 2. The Land is Mine. For the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession, ye shall grant a redemption for the land. The Word of God, as given to Moses in Leviticus. Chapter 1. The Battle of the Exodus was over. Within seconds, the words "Exodus to sail" were on the wires. Within minutes, they blazed in headlines around the world. On Cyprus, the joy of the people was boundless, and around the world there was one long sigh of relief. On the Exodus, the children were too exhausted to celebrate. The British urged Ari Ben Kanan to bring the salvage tug to dockside so that the children could be given medical care and the ship restocked and inspected. Ben Kanan agreed, and as the Exodus pulled in, Kyrenia turned into a mad scramble of activity. A score of British Army doctors swarmed onto the ship and quickly removed the more severe cases. A hastily improvised hospital was established at the Dome Hotel. Rations and clothing and supplies poured onto the dock. In addition, hundreds of gifts from the people of Cyprus deluged the ship. Royal engineers combed the ancient tug from stem to stern to patch leaks, overhaul the motor, and refit her. Sanitation teams made her spotless. After an initial survey, Ari was advised it would take several days to get the children strong enough and the ship fit enough to make the day and a half run to Palestine. The small Jewish community on Cyprus sent a delegation to Ari to appeal to him to allow the children to celebrate the first night of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, on Cyprus before sailing. The holiday was to begin in a few days. Ari agreed. Only after Kitty had been assured and reassured that Karen's condition was not serious did she allow herself the luxury of a steaming hot tub, a thick steak, a half pint of scotch, and a magnificent, deep 17-hour sleep. Kitty awoke to a problem she could no longer avoid. She had to decide either to end the episode with Karen forever or to follow the girl to Palestine. Late in the evening, when Mark came into her room for tea, she appeared none the worse for her ordeal. In fact, the long sleep had made her look quite attractive.
Newsroom still hectic?
Matter of fact, no, Mark answered. The captains and the kings are departing. The Exodus is day-old news now, the kind they wrap fish in. Oh, I suppose we can drum up a final page one picture when the boat lands in Haifa.
People are fickle.
No, not really, Kitty. The world just has a habit of moving on. She sipped her tea and sank into silence. Mark lit a cigarette and propped his feet on the windowsill. He pretended his fingers were a pistol and pointed over his shoe tops out at the pier.
What about you, Mark?
Me? Old Mark Parker has worn out his welcome in the King's domains. I'm going stateside and then maybe take a crack at the Asian beat. I've had an itch to go there anyhow. I hear it runs crosswise.
The British won't let you into Palestine?
Not a chance. I am held in very low esteem. In fact, if they weren't proper Englishmen, I'd say they hate my guts. Frankly, I don't blame them.
Give me a cigarette.
Mark lit one and handed it to her. He bided his time, continuing to take target practice with his imaginary pistol.
Damn you, Mark. I hate that smug way you have of reading my mind.
You've been a busy little girl. You went to the British authorities to ask permission to enter Palestine. Being the gentleman they are, they opened the door for you and bowed. You were just a clean-cut American girl doing her duty. Of course, CID doesn't know about your little rum-running act for Aliyah Bet. Well, are you going or not?
God, I don't know.
You mean you haven't talked yourself into it yet?
I mean, I don't know.
So, which side do you want me to take?
You could stop acting like a worldly Buddha looking down on the poor tormented mortals, and you could stop sniping at me, Mark.
Mark dropped his feet from the windowsill. Go on. Go to Palestine. That's what you want to hear, isn't it?
I still don't feel right around Jewish people. I can't help it.
You feel fine around that girl, though, don't you? Does she still remind you of your daughter?
Not really. Not anymore. She is too much of herself to be anyone else. But I love her and want her, if that's what you mean.
I've got a loaded question for you, Mrs. Fremont.
Go on.
Are you in love with Ari Ben Kanan?
Love Ari Ben Kanan?
She knew that he affected her whenever he was near, or spoke, or looked at her, or even when she thought of him. She knew she had never met another man exactly like him. She knew she had a certain fear of his dark quietness and his tremendous power. She knew she admired his daring and courage. She knew there were moments she loathed him as she had never loathed another human being. But love?
I don't know, she murmured. As much as I cannot walk into it, I can't seem to be able to walk away from it, and I don't know why. I don't know why.
Later, Kitty spent over an hour with Karen in the hospital ward that had been set up on the second floor of the hotel. Karen had made a remarkable recovery. In fact, the doctors were amazed with the near magic effect the two words, Eretz Yisrael, had on all the children. It was more potent than any medicine. As Kitty sat with Karen, she looked out over the faces of the children in the ward. Who were they? Where did they come from? Where were they going?
What strange, strange people. What a strange, strange obsession they carried.
There were long periods of silence between Kitty and Karen in which neither of them dared broach the subject of her coming on to Palestine. At last, Karen fell asleep. Kitty stared down at the girl. How lovely she was. How very lovely. She kissed Karen's forehead and stroked her hair, and Karen smiled in her sleep. She walked out to the corridor where Dov Landau was pacing back and forth. They both halted, stared at each other, and Kitty passed on wordlessly. The sun was setting as Kitty walked out to the quay. Across the street, Zev Gilboa and Yoav Yarkoni were supervising the loading of materials aboard the salvage tug. She looked about quickly to catch a glimpse of Ari. He was not in sight.
Shalom, Kitty,
they called to her.
Hi,
she called back. She walked on down the quay toward the lighthouse. It was getting chilly. She put on her sweater.
I must know. I must know. I must.
She repeated over and over to herself. Out on the edge of the seawall sat young David Ben-Ami. He seemed lost in thought, looking out over the water and flipping pebbles. She came up alongside him, and he looked up and smiled.
Shalom, Kitty. You look rested.
She sat beside him. For several moments they admired the sea.
Thinking of home?
She asked.
Yes. Yordana, that's her name, isn't it? Ari's sister?
David nodded.
Will you see her? If I am lucky, we will have a little time. David?
Yes.
What is going to become of the children? We will take good care of them. They are our future. Is there danger?
Yes, there is great danger.
Kitty was quiet again for many moments.
Are you sailing with us?
David asked. She felt her heart skip a beat.
Why do you ask?
It is beginning to seem natural to have you around. Besides, Ari mentioned something or other about it.
If Ari is interested, then why doesn't he ask?
David laughed.
Ari doesn't ask for anything. David, she said abruptly, you must help me. I am terribly puzzled. You seem to be the only one who understands a little. I will help you if I can. I haven't been around many Jews in my life. You people bewilder me.
We bewilder ourselves even more, David said.
Can I say something honestly? I feel so much like an outsider.
That is not at all strange, Kitty. Most people do. Even those few we call friend, even though they have a loyalty bordering on fanaticism. Some, I believe, feel guilty for all the crimes committed against us. Others want to be Jews, although Lord only knows why. We are a confusing lot.
But a man like Ari Ben Kanan, who is he? Who is he really? Is he a real person?
Ari is quite real.
He is the product of a historic abortion.
They began walking toward the hotel, for it was supper time.
It is difficult to know where to begin, David said. I suppose to really tell the story of Ari Ben Kanan, we must start with Simon Rabinsky in the Jewish Pale. The Pale was an area in southwest Russia that included the Ukraine. I suppose we'd have to start before the turn of the century. I think the year of the great happening was 1884.
Chapter 2. Zhytomyr, Russia, 1884. Simon Rabinsky was a bootmaker. His wife's name was Rachel. She was a good and a devout woman. Simon had two sons who were his greatest treasures. Yakov, the younger, was 14 years of age. He was a fiery lad with a whiplash tongue and a quick mind. He would argue at the slightest provocation. Yossi, the older of the brothers, was 16. Yossi's appearance was distinctive. He was a powerful giant who stood over 6 feet tall and had a head of flaming red hair like his mother, Rachel. Yossi was as mild as Yakov was wild. Yossi was quiet and meditative and gentle. In fact, Yakov's fertile brain in Yossi's powerful body could well have created a Superman. The Rabinsky family was extremely poor. They lived in that part of western Russia which included Bessarabia, the Ukraine, the Crimea, and parts of White Russia, and which was known as the Jewish Pale of Settlement. The boundaries of the Pale were established in 1804 as the only place in Russia where Jews could reside. It was, in fact, one enormous ghetto, with Moscow and Petrograd off-limits, except to those few wealthy Jews who could bribe their way into sending a son or a daughter beyond the boundaries. Establishment of the Jewish Pale was merely one event in a long history of discrimination. Jews first settled in Russia in the Crimea area as far back as the first century. The Khazars who ruled in that area were so taken with Judaism that they adopted it as their own religion. The Khazars' kingdom was, in fact, a Jewish state. By the 10th century, the Russians in the north had ascended to power, and they swept down on the Khazars, dispersed them to oblivion, and began a sordid record against the Jews. As Russia came to power, the flaming sword of Islam came up from the south. During those periods when the Muslims held parts of Russia, the Jews knew their greatest times of peace and prosperity, for Jews had been a potent factor behind the rise of Islam. With the final defeat of the Muslims, full power over all Russia went to the Tsars and to the Greek Church. Jewish heretics were burned at the stake by the hundreds during the Middle Ages. The ignorant peasantry was well instructed in the fable that these Jews were magicians and witches and used Christian blood in their rituals. Centuries of unrelieved abuse reached a climax during the reign of Catherine I. A series of pogroms, anti-Jewish riots, was unloosed against those who would not accept the Greek Orthodox religion. But attempts to convert the Jews failed utterly, So Catherine I expelled 1 million Jews from Russia. Most of them went to Poland. After this came the era of war and conquest, in which Poland was conquered and reconquered, partitioned and repartitioned. Catherine II inherited 1 million of the Jews who had previously been expelled by Catherine I. These events led directly to the establishment of the Jewish Pale. In 1827, Jews were driven ruthlessly from the smaller villages into the already overcrowded Jewish quarters in the larger cities. In the same year, the Tsar instituted a quota of Jewish youths to be turned over each year to the army for 25 years of military service. Simon Rabinsky, the bootmaker of Zhytomyr, his good wife Rachel, and his sons Yaakov and Yossi were prisoners of the Pale and of a unique way of life. There was no social and very little commercial contact between these Jewish communities and the rest of the Russian people. The only regular visitor from the outside was the tax collector, who might make off with anything from sacred candlesticks to beds and pillows and shoes. Frequent but less regular callers from the outside were the wild mobs of Cossacks and peasants and students who screamed for Jewish blood. Divorced from the greater society, the Jews had little or no loyalty for Mother Russia. Their spoken and written language was not Russian but Yiddish, which was a bastard German. Their language of prayer was ancient Hebrew. The Jews even dressed differently. They wore black hats and long gabardine coats. Although it was forbidden by law, many of them wore side curls, and it was a great sport among the Russians to catch a Jew and cut off his curls. Simon Rabinsky lived the way his father and his father's father had been forced to live inside ghetto walls. Because they were so poor, there was endless haggling over a few kopecks. Yet, despite the desperateness of their daily existence, Simon and all other Jews adhered to rigid codes of business ethics inside the ghetto. No man was allowed to infringe on the livelihood of his neighbor or to cheat.